Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to World Christianity, a special series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for those who would like to explore the expansive discourse on world Christianity as a global phenomenon and as an emerging field that examines Christianity's cross-cultural, diasporic, and transnational manifestations by paying close attention to the underrepresented and marginalized expressions of the Christian faith in the global South. Thank you for joining me today. I'm excited to share this interview with you all. I'm your host, Byung-ho Choi from Princeton Theological Seminary. Kwame Bediako, African Theology for a World Christianity, written by Tim Hartman and published by Langham Publishing in 2021, is the first full-length introduction to Kwame Bediako's theology, and that which examines the incredible contributions of the Ghanaian theologian Kwame Bediako, one of the greatest African theologians of his generation. While pushing back against the assumption that Christianity is a Western religion, Kwame Bediako called for a non-Western foundation for a theological reflection, expanded the Christian theological imagination, and offered a path forward for post-Christendom theologies. In this monograph, Hartman engages Bediako's central concerns with identity, specifically what it means to be African and Christian in the aftermath of the failures of colonialism, the relationship of theology and culture, and the need of indigenous expressions of Christian faith for the health of theological reflection worldwide. Challenging stereotypical perceptions of African Christianity and pressing readers to interrogate their own theological convictions in light of cultural and societal presumptions, Hartman's work examines the gift of Bediako's work not just for Africa, but for the world. Over the course of our conversation today, we will take a closer look at this important work, how this book and this contribution of Kwame Bediako aids the readers in better understanding African Christianity, and how scholars and students of world Christianity stand to greatly benefit from this book. To learn more about these issues and more, please stay tuned, and we hope you enjoy the book and our conversations as well. Today, we are privileged to talk with Tim Hartman, the author of Kwame Bediako, African Theology for a World Christianity. Tim Hartman is Associate Professor of Theology at Columbia Theological Seminary. His research focuses on contemporary Christian theologies worldwide, Christology, lived theology, and the interrelationship between religious beliefs and practices, and the work of Kwame Bediako and Karl Barth. Tim has also presented on a wide range of topics at various conferences and institutions, such as the American Academy of Religion, International Karl Barth Conference in Stellenbosch University, and the World Christianity Conference at Princeton Theological Seminary. His list of publications also includes critical insights on Karl Barth, African Traditional Religions, Kwame Bediako, and Christianity in Africa. Tim's first monograph, Theology After Colonization, Kwame Bediako, Karl Barth, and the Future of Theological Reflection, published by University of Notre Dame Press in 2020, examines the work of two theologians, Karl Barth and Kwame Bediako, to gain insight into our contemporary theological situation, how the loss of cultural hegemony through rising pluralism and secularization has undermined the interconnection of the Christian faith with political power, and how globalization undermined the expansive and expanding mindset of colonization. His other publications also include a chapter titled Karl Barth in the book T.N.T. Clark Companion to Theological Anthropology, published by T.N.T. Clark Bloomsbury in 2020, and Humanity and Destiny, a Theological Comparison of Karl Barth and African Traditional Religions in the volume Karl Barth and Comparative Theologies, published by Fordham University Press in 2019. His chapter in the monograph Religion, Culture, and Spirituality in Africa and the African Diaspora, titled An Act of Theological Negritude, Kwame Bediako on African Christian Identity, published by Routledge in 2016, is also a great chapter that all readers should read as well. His journal publications also include African Religions as Parables of the Kingdom, Karl Barth and Kwame Bediako on Revelation and Culture, published in the Stellenbosch Theological Journal in 2019, and The Promise of an Actualistic Pneumatology, Beginning with the Holy Spirit in African Pentecostalism and Karl Barth, published in the Journal of Modern Theology in 2017. Tim is also ordained as a minister in the Presbyterian Church, USA. So welcome, Dr. Hartman, to New Books Network in World Christianity. And thank you so much for taking the time today to talk about your book.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here and to talk with you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. First of all, I think we have some important news to share with our listeners today. I believe that there are currently two publishers for this book, Langham Publishing and Fortress Press. Currently, Langham Publishing has already released this book for those located in Europe and the Global South. And if I'm not mistaken, we have this exact same book being released by Fortress Press for our readers situated in North America. And I believe that will be in February of 2022. So is this correct, Dr. Hartman?
It is correct. It was important to me that this book could be widely available to its various readerships. So as the editor at Langham, a man named Peter Quant, knew Kwame Bediako years ago, and Peter was very interested and intent on this book, really when it was just an idea and a dream. And as I talked with Peter about it, I was also wanted to make sure that the book could be widely available in Africa and in the developing world, because Bediako would very much have wanted that. And then I also wanted it available in North America. And so thankfully, through some, you know, some acts of international diplomacy, I was able to have Langham and Fortress work together to bring this book to be. And so the manuscript is the same for both books, but the covers are different, and Fortress did their own copy editing, so the pages are different. So the Fortress edition, I think, is about 50 pages longer, but it just has to do with font size and layout. Each book is the same.
Of course. Well, thank you for clarifying that. I think it'll be very useful for those situated worldwide, wherever you are, for our listeners. They can remember this and purchase this book according to where they're located at.
And it's worth mentioning that Langham has free global shipping.
Oh, wow.
So that's a really helpful thing to people around the world.
Thank you for that. And again, as our New Books Network serves a worldwide audience, I think this will be very helpful to know. So thank you, Dr. Hartman, for clarifying that. Now, I think it will be great to start our conversation by getting to know you a little more, Dr. Hartman. I was wondering if you can share with us about your background, where you grew up, where you did your PhD, and how you became interested in your field. And also, please feel free to mention any influential mentors you might have had along the way. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. So I actually grew up an hour north of Princeton in New Jersey, in northern New Jersey, in a small town called New Providence, and grew up there and really didn't have, I traveled a little bit growing up, mostly in the United States. I went to Europe, I think, in 10th grade with some folks from school, but that was about it. Went to college in California, and then spent my junior year abroad in Europe and in the UK particularly. And so that was significant kind of to to begin to get a greater grasp of what was happening in other parts of the world and to begin to see the United States from the outside. Spent the summer of just before my junior year in what was then Swaziland, now Eswatini, in Southern Africa. And so flew in and out of South Africa and spent 8 weeks in what I thought was the summer, but very quickly discovered was the winter in the Southern Hemisphere at the tip of Africa. And some cold weeks, but it was very helpful to learn about how people in another culture, country, continent saw and understood who God is. At that time when I was there, Swaziland had a king. There was a parliament, but the parliament really didn't do much. It was a kingdom. This was the kingdom of Swaziland. And so what I learned from fellow Christians is when they prayed to Jesus as the King of Kings, they had a very different understanding of what that means than when I gathered with fellow Americans to do that. I think I had developed a bit of an understanding of a God of democracy, that if you get enough people together and they agree, then God will do what we all agree upon. This was not the Swazi way. They like, well, the king does what the king does. Nothing we can do about that. So there's a really helpful corrective to my theology there from these Swazi Christians who were just living their lives and living out their theologies and how they believed it and the ways that their culture had shaped their understanding of God that was super helpful to me. I took that experience. I then, after college, I did an internship in a church for a couple of years in Seattle. And then I was doing high school ministry then, and then went to Princeton Seminary for 3 years and got my Master's of Divinity, and then served as a pastor for 9 years, first in Los Angeles and then in Baltimore. And at this point was also when the emerging church movement was beginning and growing in the United States. And it nurtured in me this desire to see how church in the United States could be relevant to cultural changes in the United States. And so I started thinking about those things as well. I got involved with some folks, Brian McLaren and some folks doing Amahoro Africa, which is a small little organization. But it got me first to Uganda and Rwanda and then to Burundi as well. And helped me to it helped me to really see the ways that Africans were wrestling with questions of faith in the 21st century in ways that I wasn't as familiar with. And so this was exciting. And so these various, I was found myself thinking really big questions while also pastoring. And that's what led me to apply to PhD programs. Ended up going to the University of Virginia, got a PhD in theology, ethics, and culture. It's a PhD in religious studies. In the religious studies concentration was in theology, ethics, and culture. And my concentration was in philosophical theology. But then my dissertation looked at both Karl Barth, who I'd been exposed to growing up in the Presbyterian Church, as well as Kwame Badiako. I can remember sitting in the stacks in the Alderman Library at the University of Virginia, and I was taking a comprehensive exam in African Christianity, and was reading some Badiako, and just became really intrigued with what Badiako was saying. And so I emailed a friend of mine, a man named Tim Dearborn, who'd worked for World Vision and some other organizations. And I was like, by any chance, did you know Kwame Badiako? Well, about a couple hours later, by the afternoon, he had written an email that said, "Dear Jillian, meet my friend Tim." He'd written to Kwame's widow because he and his wife, Carrie, had been in Aberdeen with Kwame and Jillian when they were all getting their PhDs together back in the late 70s. And so this kind of got me introduced to Auntie Mary, as she's known, Jillian Mary Badiako, Kwame's widow. And that then allowed me to plan some research trips to Ghana, and kind of the work took off from there. So that maybe is a little longer answer than you were thinking, but it gets us kind of into some of the material.
No, I mean, thank you for that answer. And thank you for sharing about this process, this journey that you took into writing this book. And it's just fascinating, those little connections that develop into what becomes a book itself. So thank you for sharing that. Now I would like to ask if you could tell us more about how you came to write this great book. I know you just mentioned that that small connection, that beginning. But this great book, Kwame Bediako, African Theology for a World Christianity, where did this journey begin and how did this idea develop? And what led you to examining the contributions of Kwame Bediako and of African theology? It would be great to hear your story as this monograph kind of builds on your previous research. And I think I mentioned in your bio some of the work that you've been doing previously and before this book came out. And I believe that your work has led to you to also travel the world, as you just mentioned, and visiting, you know, multiple countries, Ghana, South Africa, and so forth. And if I may just briefly squeeze in one more question here, and please feel free to answer in just consecutive order, but I'm curious to know what your research process and writing experience was like, especially as you have expressed in your own words in the beginning pages of your book, you were approaching this as an outsider to Bediako's world. So, Dr. Hartman.
Mm-hmm. That's a helpful place to begin, because you're absolutely right. I am not African. Mm-hmm. I am of white European descent. And I do come to African theology as an interested outsider, with deep appreciation for what is happening in African theology and in the movement of the Spirit of God on the continent of Africa. And so for me, I tried to be very aware of my position, in the sense that it is a privilege and a luxury for me to be able to fly to Africa and spend the time there, and that I've had institutions, both the University of Virginia and Columbia Theological Seminary, that have paid for those things, as well as grants from the Louisville Institute to pay for my time and my travel. And so that, in many ways, the writing of this book started that moment in the library, the University of Virginia, a number of years ago now, over a decade by now ago. And by the willingness of Jillian Mary Bediako, Dr. Bediako, to have me come and to spend about a week there, and her willingness to open up her archives of Kwame's work. When I was there at the Kofi Christaller Institute outside Accra, in a town called Akrapong, I would show up in the library in the morning, and one of Dr. Bediako's assistants would bring me a file and you know, say something like, "Auntie Mary thinks you'll be interested in what's in here." And so I would have this kind of treasure hunt. I would open it up and see the essay that Bediako wrote when he applied for his PhD program. I'd see sermons, right, that are unpublished. I'd see his dissertation with the edits on it when it went to be turned into Theology and Identity. I got to read his French master's and French dissertation. And so all sorts of just amazing connections and contacts that were made there, really because of her generosity and willingness to allow me to undertake this project. So, and then for this book in particular, so in another way, it started out as a dissertation. And my dissertation itself, it had a really boring structure. It had five chapters. The first chapter was the introduction. There was then a Bediako chapter, a Bart chapter. Chapter four was on both, kind of a comparative chapter. And chapter five was a conclusion. It was entirely unreadable. Like, it wasn't bad work, but like, you couldn't publish this. Because it kind of didn't have a thread that tied it all together. So I can remember, after I laid my dissertation sit for a year, after my first year teaching here at Columbia, I printed it all out and I sorted it on the floor of my office into basically new themes, what this would look like, and to see how I could make my book out of it. So the bulk of that first book, my first book has two parts. I wrote part one new. That was all new work. But part two is a thematically rearranged engagement of Bediako and Bart around themes of revelation, religion, and culture. So I finished that project, and then I become aware that I have a whole chunk of material on Bediako that didn't go in that first book. And I also felt a debt that all of this had been invested in me. not just by institutions, but by Ghanaians, by Auntie Mary, by ACI. And I had the space and the opportunity to write, to put that work together that I had really previously written, to rewrite it, to revise it, and then to create what I hope is a really accessible, not too long, introduction to Bediako's theology. Yeah. So I hope that can be a gift and a conversation starter for many.
Well, thank you for sharing with us that fascinating journey you took and those stories of how you lay out everything on your office floor. And those kind of little stories are like the nuggets where we get to hear from the author, about what entailed into, writing this book and into digging deep into the life of Kwame Bediako and African theology. So thank you so much for sharing that. Now, as we take a closer look at the book, we can see that there are a total of 7 chapters, and this is excluding the introduction and conclusion, which are also uniquely and intriguingly titled. I love the way you titled each and every chapter. It kind of builds upon the other, and you can see throughout the book, it's very accessible. It's very it's not too hard read. For me, it was an easy read in a way that you delineate everything so well. And one aspect I would like to highlight for our listeners is that Dr. Hartman, our author himself, provides a chronological listing of Kwame Bediako's writings at the end. So for scholars or students, this is a very practical resource for those interested in studying Bediako's work. Just by going through that list itself, we are able to see that Bediako's contributions and how he was a prolific writer as well. So Dr. Hartman, in the introduction, you lay out some general facts about Kwame Bediako, his life, his education, and Bediako's approach to understanding Christianity. And I appreciated the fact that you were very direct from the beginning, that the aim of your book is not to provide this biography of Kwame Bediako, but instead to highlight his, ideas rather than his life. That being said, you do, extensively cover a significant part of Bediako's life because it is, very much needed to, show Bediako's life as his experience goes parallel to much of what he has to contribute regarding African theology. But it is also here that you explain how you are undertaking this task of wanting to educate the readers about Christian theologies outside of the West, especially which have originated from the African context. To help us put on some new lenses, I think that's the way you put it in your book, to put on some new lenses in understanding Christianity or, world Christianity. And I remember how you mentioned 3 key words in the beginning pages of your book, identity, gospel, and culture. And I would like to kind of bring them into the spotlight right now. I think these words are key as they serve as an overarching framework for your book and as they prove to be very helpful in thinking about the questions that both Bediako engages in his work and in which you also seek to address in this very book. So Dr. Hartman, as we take a deep dive into your book, I was wondering if you could begin by talking on more of these concepts, identity, gospel, and culture. Why are they so relevant to both Bediako and your own work?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Matt. For that. Those are 3 very significant themes for Bediako. But before I think about those, I want to affirm 2 of the things that you said in the beginning of the question. One, I am so pleased you appreciate the chronological listing. I had to fight hard for that with the publishers, right? It's a lot of pages. Bediako wrote over 75 articles and book chapters, and it's there's a lot there, but I find it really helpful to have it organized chronologically, both to track the development of Bediako's thought. And also, he was very busy. He wrote in the margins of life that as he was spending a lot of his time beginning and then administrating the Akrofi Christaller Institute for Theology, Mission, and Culture, that was the bulk of his time. He would write in response to invitations, but didn't have always the luxury to write as much as he wanted. So he became an amazing at borrowing from himself, of taking things he'd already written and then working them up, sometimes editing them, sometimes not, for other occasions. And that the chronological listing helps to track some of that as well, to see some of his own roots. And I, on this note about a biography, there's tons about Bediako's life that I leave out. And it's intentional on my part to keep this book focused on his theology. And I do hope that I think a biography could and should be written of Betty Ocko. It's not mine to write, but I think I hope that it will happen and happen soon. That his life and the kind of the amazing life that he led could be described in one complete story. So thank you for those 2 points. So on to these questions about identity, gospel, and culture. These are perhaps the most significant themes in Betty Ocko's work. This question of identity, he felt very personally. He wrestled with what it meant to be African and Christian, and did so particularly in the aftermath of colonialism. So he had achieved its independence from the UK at that point in the late 1950s when Betty Ocko was about 14 years old. And so he came of age just as his country was coming of age, and then was around as Ghana tried to figure out how to govern itself on the other side of colonialism. And so he, as Betty Ocko went to university at the University of Ghana, he was majoring in French and was exposed to all the French existentialists, and reading Sartre and others, Betty Ocko became a self-described atheist. And it wasn't until later that Betty Ocko converts to Christianity and has to, and wrestles with what it then means not to be a European Christian, but to be an African Christian. So these questions of identity, they permeate all that he's doing, because he wants other Africans to become Christians, but to become truly African Christians, where their theology emerges from Africa itself. And so he then understands the gospel as indigenous to Africa, that God has been at work in Africa for as long as there have been people on the continent and even before. One of his later lectures, the title of it was that the missionaries did not bring Christ, but Christ brought them. And so that he's grateful to the missionaries that they did bring the name of Jesus Christ and that they translated the Bible into indigenous languages. But other than that, it's a fallacy to think that white people brought God with them. And so Betty Ocko is very insistent that the gospel itself, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is indigenous to Africa. And then he wants to understand that gospel from the culture in the context of Africa, and particularly from Ghana, and then to understand that everyone is shaped by the culture that we live in and that we grow up in. He'll, borrowing from the British, he talks about cultural blinkers. In America, we might call these blinders, right? And I think of a horse, you know, with blinders on in a horse race, right? The keep it focused forward. Well, Bariako's image of this is that culture does that for us, and that's not actually helpful. That while it may help a horse to run fast and run straight, that blinds us from what's happening around us, and we don't see the bigger picture. We only see what our culture has taught us to see. And so Bariako found himself as one raised in Africa, but educated for his graduate work in Europe. He saw things differently than fellow European students, than some of his European professors, certainly than other European Christians. And he wanted to use that difference and to say to them, hey, there's a whole other understanding of who God is in Jesus Christ that you may be missing. And I'm going to present that to you as an African. And that's a bit where his second book, Christianity in Africa, The Renewal of a Non-Western Religion, really comes through. So that's a bit of an overview of those three terms for him.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hartman, for, you know, painting those broad strokes, because, you know, we'll be revisiting these three key concepts, you know, throughout the chapters and throughout our questions. And I think having these words in the back of your mind in reading your work is very helpful, because, you know, it comes repeatedly over and over again. And as you have just mentioned right now, you discussed the concept of identity in more in depth, playing a central role in Kwame Bediako's life and his work. And you're very, very thorough about this in the very first chapter. I think this really has a deep meaning, because, you know, it's early early years of Bediako that we see this. And I think in order to better appreciate why Bediako wrestled with this concept of identity for nearly 40 years in his writing, it is pertinent to touch upon the, you know, as you mentioned, the social political context of Bediako's time, his education and early challenges he faced, and even his own conversion to Christianity, you know, as he and his use of concepts like negritude in his own journey of establishing an African Christian identity. So, Dr. Hartman, do you mind saying more on these aspects, and especially on Bediako's early years, and how this all connects to his work in writing about African Christianity, as this will all be very helpful for us to understand the roots kind of his work?
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned a bit about the atheism that Bediako embraced as an undergraduate, and then he went from the University of Ghana. He got a scholarship from the University of Ghana to go to the University of Bordeaux in France and study Francophone literature. So this is not a theological degree, right? He's studying literature, first getting a master's, and he's studying a Congolese poet named Chikaya Utomsi, who was exiled from Congo to Paris. And so he's steeped in these authors of negritude, of Aimé Césaire and Frantz Fanon and others. And so negritude was this approach of, it was, Césaire invents this word to begin to think about how to recover the Black past. And Bediako then, one of my claims is that he then is doing this theologically, that he seeks to recover an African past for Christian theology. That's jumping ahead. He's not there yet. He's stuck in these authors of negritude. And so the time comes for him to write his master's thesis, and he develops writer's block. And he just can't write. And apparently writing usually came pretty easily to him, and he just couldn't write. And he'd been spending a lot of time with Christians in Bordeaux, but in a way so that he could argue with them. He was essentially an evangelist for atheism in his own mind in a way at this point, and was seeking to persuade Christians that what they believed was not true, or that there was no basis for their belief. Well, as he's fighting writer's block, and I narrate this in one of the early chapters, Bediako was, he says that he was standing in the shower and he'd not yet turned on the tap, but his feet started getting wet. He was crying. And he came, in this moment, as he tells the story, he had a conversion experience to God and Jesus Christ. And this then freed him of his writer's block. He finished his master's. He then wanted to immediately abandon all of his graduate work and do theological work. But he was persuaded to stay, and his master's was on negritude and surrealism, looking at the work of Chikaya Utomsi. And then as his work continued, then he was still wrestling with this question of identity. You can, one of the most profound ways to see this is that to look at the footnotes and the sources that Bediako used between his master's thesis and his doctorate. In his doctorate, which gets called, to translate, it's the interior universe of Chikaya Utomsi. And so he really begins to narrate, Chikaya was full of angst. And Bediako begins to narrate this angst. And in his master's, it's all the authors from negritude. And then in his doctorate, there's a Bible verse on nearly every page. It's a radical change in sources. And as he really seeks to plot and to understand this interior universe of Chikaya. And his claim, in a sense, is that Chikaya was missing God and Jesus Christ. This is a radical claim to be making at a French university in the 1970s. And he knew that, and he was happy to do it anyway. And this then propelled him to continue this work on identity. So when he then got a master's in theology at London Bible College, now London School of Theology. While he was there, he met Andrew Walls. That began a friendship that lasted the rest of his life. as he then went up to Aberdeen to study with Andrew Walls. So he gets a PhD with Andrew Walls, and his dissertation with Walls is it's originally called Theology and Integration. And then when it gets, so he finishes that in 1983. When it gets published in 1993, it's called Theology and Identity. And this becomes his first book, where he looks at four Greco-Roman authors and compares them to four 20th century African theologians, and basically claims that they're doing the same thing, that Justin Martyr and Tertullian and these Haitian, they're wrestling with what does it mean to be Christian in the Greco-Roman period, and that those theological and cultural wrestlings can be very aptly compared to the wrestlings that were taking place in the 1950s and 60s in African theology, in authors like John Mbiti and Biancato and others, that as they were trying to think about what it meant to be Christian after at the tail end of colonization. And what this, it's a whole narrative. It's a big, thick book. It's a whole narrative of identity and what is Christian identity. And so that's a bit of what happens in that chapter, as both Bediako's personal narrative of trying to sort through this question, he then finds others that have sorted through that question themselves. And he doesn't ever say this quite explicitly, but I get the sense that in reading both the Greco-Roman authors and the earlier African Christian theologians, he helped himself to narrate and then understand these questions.
Thank you for that answer. And we will return in regards to how Bediako, utilizes these authors, Greco-Roman authors, in his work in our later question. But now thinking about the second chapter, for our listeners who might be interested in the field of world Christianity, this second chapter might be of great interest as it is titled Translatability, Relevance Without Syncretism. The reason why I say this is because for students and scholars in world Christianity, this word translatability is a familiar term and quite important, as we have early pioneers of world Christianity that you just mentioned, Dr. Hartman, Andrew Walls, and even Lamin Sane, who have greatly contributed to this very discourse and whom, you know, you've mentioned, you know, throughout your book as well. And if I was to just briefly summarize on Walls and Sane's understanding of translatability principle, Walls would argue that, you know, God chose translation as God's mode of action for the salvation of humanity, and that the incarnation of Christ the Word was divinity translated into humanity, and that this was done under the very culture-specific conditions. For Lamin Sane, it was by translatability Christianity expressed its universal ethos, its capacity to enter into each cultural idiom fully and seriously enough to commence a challenging and enduring dialogue. Both of these words were, taken from the works of very Walls and Sane. But for Sane, translation served as the core of cross-cultural mission, with Christianity interpreted as dynamic translation movement and the translation of the Bible kind of laying the cornerstone for religious evolution of African communities, as it gave reform, renewal, and revival for African Christianity. And we see also that kind of being very influential in the life of and the work of Bediako as well. So with Walls and Sane serving as Bediako's close interlocutors, translatability for Bediako was another way of saying, in your words, I want to put this in quote, universality. In other words, for Bediako, the translatability of the Christian religion signifies its fundamental relevance and accessibility to persons in any culture within which the Christian faith is transmitted and assimilated. As did with Walls and Sane, translation of the Bible also serves, again, as a crucial factor for Bediako's thought and in African Christianity. And it is by this foundation that, as Dr. Hartman, you highlight, Bediako claims that Christianity is indigenous to Africa. So, Dr. Hartman, as you delineate Bediako's understanding of translatability in this chapter, the second chapter, you also mentioned some of the critiques that Bediako received from African theologians, such as Emmanuel Katagongole. So do you mind elaborating on some of the critiques that other African theologians might have had on Bediako's work?
No, absolutely. There's there's a lot there in your question, right? Thinking about translation. Mm-hmm. I first want to say that it would have been so fun to have been in Aberdeen in the early 1980s when Walls and Sana and Bediako were all there, when they were all spending time together. Walls is the chair of the department. Sana is teaching in that department in one of his early teaching roles. Bediako is a graduate student. I can only imagine what those, I don't know how often the three of them had a conversation, but I would like to think it happened a lot, but I don't actually know. What I can say is that, so Bediako cited Sana over 75 times throughout his works and had a deep fondness for Sana's work and particularly for this work on translation. I think particularly like through Bediako's perspective about Sana, both at his book, Translating the Message, as well as an essay that Sana published in the International Bulletin for Missionary Research in October of 1983 on the horizontal and the vertical in mission in African perspective. These really did seem seminal for Bediako in thinking about translation. And thinking about Bediako thought about translation a couple different ways. This is part of what's complex of thinking with Bediako about translation. Certainly he thought of what might be the first level, the literal understanding of translation. He thought of language being translated and thought a lot about language and what it meant to have people have access to scripture in the vernacular. Well, second, he also thought about the translation of ideas. In part, this is where Sana was super helpful to him in thinking about what does it mean to take these theological ideas that have been around for thousands of years? How do we understand them in an African context? But then he also thinks about the infinite translatability of Jesus Christ, that Jesus Christ, is God translated into human flesh. And so you have this divine act of translation. And so part of what happens as far as Bediako and his critics on this is that Bediako uses translation in so many different ways that it's not always clear to his critics which way he's using it at a certain time. And that upsets them. So thinking about Katangale and Katangale's critique, I address this on pages 35 and 36 of my book. And actually, I'm going to read part of it because I think it helps. There's actually a lot going on, I think, in this conversation between Bediako and Katangale. And I want to get it right, not just off memory. So one difficulty with Bediako's understanding of translation is that the concept of translatability seems to take on a life of its own, becoming an independent actor. This being the idea that is it God translating here, or is translation like off and running and it's happening by itself? So for Katangale writes, quote, "There's something misleading about Bediako's attempt to prove the non-foreignness of Christianity by setting up an infinitely translatable gospel, not Christianity, as the crucial factor in missionary work." So that's from Katangale's Future for Africa. So Bediako believed that it's only by understanding and appreciating the inherent translatability of the Christian faith. And then Bediako writes, this next quote in Christianity in Africa. So Bediako believed it's only by understanding and appreciating the inherent translatability of the Christian faith that we can appreciate the true character of the continuing Christian witness and enhance the genuine development of new indigenous traditions of Christian thought. So even in that brief paragraph, there's a lot happening. And part of what's happening there with Katangale and Bediako, I think, is a bit of a Protestant and Catholic disagreement. Bediako is a self-described African evangelical. Bediako is very interested in the gospel. It's worth asking what he means by gospel, but this is his primary, the gospel is what's important to Bediako. Katangale is Roman Catholic and is critiquing Bediako for a lack of discussion, belief in the institutional church. Katangale wants the church, in his case, the Roman Catholic Church, to be the primary actor theologically. And on this point, Bediako and Katangale, they just disagree. And they disagree on a very deep kind of a theological ecclesial level. It's now getting worked out on the level of translation. So I actually think that they're not having a conversation at this moment about translation itself. They're actually having a conversation about ecclesiology and which whether a more Protestant or more Catholic ecclesiology is better. So that's the Katangale piece. But this question of for Bediako, translation does so much work for Bediako in his writing and in his theology that one could wonder whether it gets a life of its own. Bediako, if asked, he would not say that. He would always point to Jesus Christ. But it's a question worth asking.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that thorough answer. I wanted to bring this up because, you know, this is not the first time. Well, there are several instances where other theologians also, you know, question Kwame Bediako and his work and, you know, have a discussion regarding his work as well. And I thought it was important to, you know, kind of put into the limelight of these interactions between other African theologians as well. But once again, thank you for that answer. And I think that one of the notable contributions of Bediako's work that you highlight in the next third chapter is his tremendous effort in trying to, if I may quote you, quote, bring African Christian thought out from the looming shadow of Western Christian thought. I think that I really like this quote. And this is to establish this idea that the Christian is indigenous, Christianity is indigenous to Africa. And we see Bediako attempting this through history by connecting the contemporary African Christianity to its Christian past or the pre-Christendom Christianity. Especially as I think we mentioned, engaging in early Christian authors, the Tatian, the Syrian, Tertullian of Carthage, Justin Martyr of Rome, and Clement of Alexandria. And in my close reading of your book, I remember how the work of Clement of Alexandria significantly influences Bediako as well, especially in locating the foundation of African Christianity in African primal religions. So, Dr. Armin, could you explain a little more on how Bediako draws from these early writers and how he utilizes their approaches, and especially on his use of the controversial word "primo" as a positive term in his reconstruction of the history of African Christianity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. There's a key moment in one of Bediako's last public lectures where he's giving a tribute to Andrew Walls and compares. Bediako compares himself to Justin Martyr and Bediako and Walls to Justin Martyr's mentor. So there is this figure of Justin Martyr. It does play a subtle, not terribly obvious, but almost as a model of how Bediako understood his own work. And so this question of primal, by the time Bediako's writing in the late 20th century, primal has a very bad and well-earned bad reputation. Particularly from the 1910 Edinburgh Conference. Primal was a way of primarily Europeans describing Africans and others as backward, as uneducated, as uneducatable, as lesser. And in ways that now in the 21st century we probably would even call racist. And Bediako seeks to reclaim primal, in a sense, by going back behind the 20th century, behind Edinburgh, and really thinks of primal in its most basic meaning. He's thinking about primal and things connected to the earth. I think of primal urges, even. These things that we feel without thinking. And what Bediako wants to do is really think about the primal imagination, that if we are connected to that which is around us, when we're stripped down to our most basic, that when we're not enlightenment humans who are all enlightened after Rousseau and all these big thoughts, like at our most basic, what's our imagination? What does that look like? And what Bediako claims, and many of this is truly indebted to Andrew Walls, and where Walls kind of started. Bediako then ran with it, but if we have that primal imagination, how does that then connect us to God? And what Bediako claims is this primal imagination is the substructure of Christianity. And so for Africans, it's easier to point to what the primal imagination is. This also will then allow Bediako to have a positive understanding of African traditional religions, which he will then call evangelical preparation for Christianity. But what it also puts him in a position where he's critiquing the West, Europe and North America, for having lost the primal imagination. He basically says, all you've got left are these relics, things like Sunday and Moon Day, right? Thor Day on Thursday. That's, we have these relics of that, you know, perhaps, around the tree at Christmas, which is not a biblical symbol at all, but is likely a Northern European pagan symbol that's been appropriated by Christians. And now we have Christmas trees in our home at Christmas time. So any of these, but I was like, all you have left are these kind of echoes of it, but you've lost touch with the primal imagination. And so for him, it's vital to understand how God is working at the most basic levels of humanity. And so he really wants to recover those and encourage other Christians to recover them and to use them in their understanding of the Christian faith.
Well, thank you for that great answer. And I've noticed that other scholars that we do study in world Christianity, you know, trying to reclaim certain words that have been, you know, oftentimes been negatively perceived in the West. And we see scholars and theologians from the Global South trying to reclaim that. And I think Bediako's work, as you've mentioned, really, you know, tries to do that with that word primal in his work and in his mindset as well. In the fourth chapter, you underscore the importance of scripture in Bediako's work. This chapter was very emphasizing the scripture aspect, and I was very curious to hear more of your thought as well on this. But for Bediako, if there is one thing that he praised the European missionaries for having done, is their translation of the Bible in African languages, which, as Bediako would argue, also, quote, weakened any Western bias in the missionaries' presentation of the gospel, end quote. For Bediako, not only was the scripture at the core of his theology, but he argued that the scriptures in the mother tongue was central to African Christianity. I really like that word, how you use mother tongue. Dr. Hammer, here I would like to kind of pose in a briefly two-part question. Do you mind unpacking how Bediako understood, you know, scripture in his engagement of the gospel and the culture? And what was so significant about this notion of mother tongue for Bediako, especially in regards to understanding the scriptures?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, because it was very important to Bediako. Yeah. In the subtitle to that, to chapter 4, I quote Bediako where he says that the word of God is always vernacular.
Yeah.
And that I think sums it all up for him, that God doesn't need someone else to translate on God's behalf to speak to any human, that God speaks to each one of us in the language closest to our heart, in the language we first heard, that Bediako refers to as the mother tongue. He gets some criticism for the gendering of that as mother tongue and not father tongue. That's worth noting, but the idea here is that it's the language that we as babies heard first that formed us. Bediako also thinks about this in one kind of offhand comment as well, as the language people swear in, it connects to primal, right? It's that which cuts the deepest. So oftentimes people will pray, right, in the language that is the closest to their heart, which is often, but not always, their first language, that would be what Bediako would refer to as their mother tongue. So Bediako is trying to cut out the European intermediaries, trying to remove the colonial imposition of languages such as French and English and Portuguese, and say, no, God, you don't need to use a European language to talk to God. God doesn't only speak English, but for Bediako, that would have meant that God speaks Ga and God speaks Twi, God speaks Uve, these languages in Ghana, and that is how people are to approach God and Jesus Christ. One interesting note on this is that the Akwofi Christdollar Institute grants PhD degrees. But one of the things that Bediako instituted was that when you write your PhD, you have to write an abstract in your mother tongue. The degrees are typically in English, But the writers typically are from all over Africa. And he wanted to make sure that any of these high, lofty intellectual ideas getting produced in a doctoral dissertation could be conveyed in a paragraph in one's mother tongue. So I think that was a kind of a helpful institutionalization of Bediako's conviction.
Well, thank you for that insight. I mean, that's very fascinating to hear. And I think very relevant too, according to what Bediako has emphasized in regarding to using mother tongue. And I remember how, you know, he also compares the works of John MBT and as well Idowu in regards to, you know, making this kind of disconnect with missionaries in the West, and then trying to make Christianity more indigenous in his work as well.
So just be careful that, because Bediako is not trying to make Christianity indigenous.
Oh yes,
right. No. He's trying to claim it's been indigenous.
Yes,
and we need to remember that it is. It's this classic moment with Bediako where he's like, "We don't have to do anything here.
Of course,
we just have to remember what's already been the case."
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. And now in the next two chapters, you invite the readers to think about matters of theology and to look at some of the complexities that Bediako wrestled with. In chapter 5, you highlight how Bediako emphasized the importance of contextual theology and how we saw, quote, "the contextual experiments of African Christian thought had exportable lessons for the other parts of the world, especially the increasingly secularized societies of Europe and North America," end quote. But what I found particularly fascinating in this chapter, Dr. Harmer, was your delineation of Bediako's Christology. Here you bring to the limelight various factors, the importance of ancestors, especially in the African traditional religions, this notion of ancestor Christology in African theology, and Bediako's own journey of locating Jesus Christ within the African culture. And I've noticed that one of the biggest challenges that Bediako faced was in regard to addressing the role of and significance of ancestors, especially as there is a close connection in African life between ancestral function and tribal politics. I was wondering, Dr. Harmon, if you could say a little more on this matter. How did Bediako navigate through this tension between the importance of ancestors in African culture and the universality of Jesus Christ?
Mm-hmm. This is very important for Bediako, and probably his best known essay is called "Jesus in African Culture, a Ghanaian Perspective." It can be found both individually as well as some of the early chapters in the collected volume of Jesus and the Gospel in Africa. And so in there, and then as a chapter in Christianity in Africa, Bediako really develops his ancestor Christology. He says that one cannot think about any African culture without thinking about ancestors, and that this is not a question that anyone in the West thinks about. Again, because of the lack of the primal imagination in the West. And Bediako then sets out to establish how can Jesus Christ be considered an African ancestor when clearly Jesus Christ is not African. And so he asks the question of what would Jesus look like if Africans thought of him? Well, he wouldn't have blonde hair and blue eyes and white skin, as you can find on way too many North American, you know, Sunday school classroom walls. Well, what would Jesus look like? And so it becomes clear to Bediako that to go about thinking about this, you can't think about Jesus' ancestry or ethnicity. So what he does is he thinks about the fact that because Jesus Christ has died and raised again, been raised again in the resurrection, that through looking at Jesus' divinity, that you can look at Jesus as the universal ancestor of all. And so this then allows all Africans, in fact, all peoples, to claim Jesus as their ancestor, what he calls the supreme ancestor. And so that then allows him to really connect, this is the kind of the cross-cultural move, to connect Jesus Christ, who of first century Palestine and Jewish descent, with 20th century Africans. So that's how he does it. It's tracked particularly in the essay and then in that chapter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And as I mentioned in the following chapter, you discuss some of the important points Bediako addresses in considering the implications of this geographic shift in the center of gravity of the worldwide Christian population, and how an intellectual shift away from treating Western thought as the center was crucial and inevitable. And one of the important points Bediako calls for is this remaking of theology and the need for scrutinizing the relationship between academic theology and grassroots theology. And this is, I think, one of the highlights of this chapter as well. But also it is here, Dr. Hartman, you also touch upon Afua Kuma, a Ghanaian female theologian, and her impact on Bediako. In my own studies and my classes here at Princeton Theological Seminary, I've also had the privilege of reading her work, Jesus of the Deep Forest. But I thought it would be pertinent to introduce her and to talk about how she impacted Bediako's work. Dr. Hartman, do you mind speaking more on this, about Afua Kuma, her work, and also how Bediako draws from her short but impactful book, Jesus of the Deep Forest? And if I may ask, how has she also helped you in your own work to understand African Christianity?
Mm-hmm. Afua Kuma is phenomenal. And I love that description you gave her as a theologian, because my guess is that she wouldn't have described herself that way. But yet she's doing theology. As a farmer who did not read or write and composed these hymns about God and Jesus Christ, and did so through the images that were available to her of mountains and lions and elephants and any number of these images that were close to her. And so Bediako, again, in Jesus in the Gospel in Africa, there's an essay called Cry Jesus that Bediako wrote about Afua Kuma. And what he does in there, and I think the way that she inspires him theologically, is this, it's grassroots theology. Afua Kuma's theology is not coming from books. And it is really coming from her lived experience in the world. And she's then using what she has been taught about who God is and the stories that she's heard in scripture to then take those and to look for ways that they are reflected in her world. And this is the work of theology, that she is taking these kind of eternal messages and seeking to understand them and to apply them in her daily life. And we're blessed that they got recorded first in Chui and then translated into English so that we have the privilege of reading them today. And the Bediako had the privilege of reading them as well. Even today, they often have copies of Jesus of the Deep Forest for sale in the bookstore at the Akofi Christal Institute because of kind of her ongoing influence that in many ways was unintentional on her part, but lasting nonetheless.
Thank you for that. So far, we have carefully looked into some of the important points to Bediako's theology, from dealing with issues of identity to unraveling some of the complexities between, you know, Christianity and the African culture and the gospel. But before we segue into the final chapter, I would like to express my sincere appreciation for your book, Dr. Hartman, as it has not only helped me to better understand African Christianity, but also challenged me to reflect on my own theological convictions as well, as a student, as well as a Christian. And this all has been very helpful. And as you pointed out in the beginning of our interview, this introduction to Bediako's theology has been very helpful and very interesting and worth reading for all our listeners as well. So thank you so much for that. In the last chapter of your book, we are introduced to some of Bediako's approach to broader matters, such as understanding of politics. One point I would like to highlight here is your treatment of Bediako's view of Islam. Even though it is not treated at length in your book, you know, there's snippets here and there, but at the end, at the last chapter, you do provide some depth. But I was wondering if you could elaborate more on this, on his approach to Islam. How does he engage with Islam in his writings? Where does he situate Islam within African religions? And does he view Islam as a threat for Christians?
Let me begin with that final question. The answer is no. Bediako does not view Islam as a threat to Christians. I find Bediako to be helpful in questions of religious pluralism. As a Ghanaian, he grew up in a multi-religious society where there were Muslims and Christians and practitioners of African traditional religions. So there's no sense of superiority of one or of that there's a threat. And this is one of the gifts then of his theology to a world that's becoming, at least to the West, that's becoming more multi-religious. And as others think that this is a problem, but I was like, it's not a problem. This is life. Let's live with this. He did definitely have a sense. He definitely viewed Christianity and Islam and African traditional religions as all African religions. They were religions of the continent of Africa. And he also felt that both African traditional religions and Islam in different ways were incomplete, and that their completeness would only be found in Christianity. And so that's how he didn't view Islam as a threat, but he also had a strong, felt that Christianity was primary, I think is the way I'd put that. So he doesn't deal in his writings a lot with Islam, but that's kind of what comes through in the moment that he does.
Yes. Well, Dr. Hartman, thank you so much for your time today to discuss your book as we examine Kwame Bediako's work and of African theology and Christianity. As we end today's interview, there is one final question I would like to ask all my guests, and that is, do you mind sharing with us what your current and future projects are and what you hope to work on?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. It's I love learning about all the current theology that's being written around the world. There's a question of where people ask questions like, where's the future of theology? Well, Bediako would answer that question that the future of theology is where the people are, where the Christians are, and the Christians are in the developing world. And so I continue to seek out and seek to learn from Christians and theologians writing and thinking and living in the developing world, and hope that I'm able to listen to them. And if I have the opportunity to amplify any of what they're saying, I seek to do so. That there's a lot of messages that many of us here in the United States in particular need to hear from the rest of the world. And so that's a bit of broad strokes of what my work entails at present, as well as continuing to seek out ways to talk about Bediako and other African theologians. So thank you for this opportunity today where I got to do that very thing.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. And I look forward to reading more of your works in the future as well. And once again, thank you so much for being on today's podcast. And thank you, everyone, so much for listening to today's episode in which we explore Tim Hartman's new book, Kwame Bediako, African Theology for a World Christianity, published by Langham Publishing in 2021. And we also have the same book coming out in Northern America by Fortress Press in February of 2022. This is your host, Byung-ho Choi, and stay tuned for the next episode on the New Books on World Christianity.